thanks for joining us for this short series that we're going to be doing through the summer months here. I'm just uploading these from home, a little bit less formal, but I hope you'll appreciate our attempt at this point to supplement a little bit some material we've done before. You may recall that a couple of years ago we did a series that I called Presbyterians and the American Revolution. And out of that we did a follow-up series last summer, which was really an attempt to understand how our Constitution was really a product of the Reformed tradition generally, the Presbyterian view, especially the Scottish Presbyterians and their ideas of division of labor and so on in government, which is very much carried forward, of course, in our Constitution. We sometimes call James Madison the father of the American Constitution, and rightly so. He was schooled, really advanced education under John Witherspoon, who was a Presbyterian scholar, immigrated here from Scotland. Actually, Madison spent an extra year studying personally, privately, under John Witherspoon just to get the sense of political philosophy as it had been developed in that Presbyterian heritage. And he obviously carried that forward and made it part of the substructure of the American Constitution. Well, it wasn't just invented out of whole cloth. I think you know that the ideas that went into the American Constitution had their roots ultimately in the Bible. We would say it traces back through the Presbyterians, back through John Calvin and so on, but obviously all of this was derived from biblical sources. In fact, the Old Testament has a rather well-developed political philosophy. Some people miss that. Of course, we tend to read the Bible for different purposes and don't always watch out for some of the items that may come before us, but the political ideas that are found there in the Old Testament are really quite impressive and were relied on rather heavily by people who were concerned about developing political philosophy in their own day, and that's certainly true with respect to the founding era. So that's really the purpose of this. I want to entitle this short series, The Biblical Roots of the American Republic. It's going to be a Bible study, just so you know, where each week we're going to be looking at a particular text of the Old Testament and asking ourselves, what does this mean politically? What's the significance of this as it was as a practical matter applied in the way in which the apparatus of government would be put together? So that's what we're going to be about as we get going. Now, as I say, you know, I've got a life like you do, and sometimes there's going to be interruptions, so I'm not sure I'll be able to stay on a pace of one of these a week. It may be one every other week, something like that, depending on the demands of the schedule. But nevertheless, I'm going to try to work through this during these summer months. And of course, it'll be available in the future as well, but I hope you'll be able to join us and stay with us as we go through this series of studies. Just to get started, I want to remind you of the great symbol of American jurisprudence that you're familiar with. This is called Lady Justice, you know, and a very famous statue. And of course, it symbolizes a lot of what we think about when we think about the whole political philosophy and jurisprudential philosophy in America. We look at her, and of course, we immediately recognize some of the conspicuous features of this work of art. She's blindfolded, reminding us that when people come before Lady Justice, they're not supposed to be given special advantages based on their birth, based on what their socioeconomic status might be. That sort of thing is going to be colossally irrelevant when it comes to evaluating what is really the fundamental question of justice as it applies in a given situation. So she's blindfolded. She doesn't care if you were born rich or poor. Your skin color doesn't matter, your ethnicity, all of that really doesn't matter at all. She wants to evaluate strictly on the basis of the actual standards of justice. And so the scales that she carries are intended to stand for that idea. She has a sword. Of course, a sword stands generally for the idea that the civil magistrate, as Paul says, doesn't bear the sword for nothing. The sword is a very important part of how the civil magistrate is going to execute justice. It may require various corporal punishments, that kind of thing. We're aware of that, and so the sword symbolizes that. You notice right at the bottom, of course, we have there a snake. Ever since the Garden of Eden, the snake has rather stood for forces of evil. And of course, the sword being executed against a serpent is entitled to remind us that the purpose here of Lady Justice is to execute judgment against evil forces. But sometimes people miss the other element there. Her right foot is resting squarely on a book. And you don't have to think about that very hard to realize that that book that stands there, that's the foundation, you might say, in many ways, for her exercise of justice is the Bible. It was presupposed that the fundamental ideas of justice were going to be found in the Bible, and certainly they were. The Bible is replete with instruction, which is supposed to give us guidance. It doesn't matter whether we live in a monarchy or a republic or democracy, whatever it might be. There are fundamental principles of political theory that are undergirding all of those. And even in the Old Testament, we see that Israel was variously under different forms of government, and yet these fundamental principles did not change. That was the fixed foundation. And the founding fathers, in many cases, give quite overt expression of appreciation for that as they derive those principles into the way in which we put together our own system of government. So really, it's an attempt to try to look at some of those matters in that way. Our first point that we want to really emphasize in this brief discussion is simply to say that every state is going to be based on root principles. There are fundamental philosophical commitments which lie beneath the particular apparatus of government that may otherwise be implemented. And in the Bible, there's no exception to that. We find the biblical story early on begins when it comes to political matters by reminding the people of God, as Moses, of course, told them in the so-called Shema of Deuteronomy chapter 6, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength." This was a reminder that there is one great authority, and that when we begin to think about political life, it's important, incumbent upon us indeed, to recognize that authority. It reminds us immediately that not everybody takes that view, you know. And so the first thing I want to talk about here a little bit is just the idea that political authority has to originate somewhere. Political authority has to have a foundational explanation, justification for its existence. On the one hand, political authority may simply be rooted in human power. Mao Zedong, of course, famously said, "All political authority comes out of the muzzle of a gun." Well, you know, I suppose from his point of view as an atheist, a communist, that was indeed the case. He took the view that if you want to exercise political authority, it's going to have to be coercive. You have to essentially cower people into submission. You have to threaten them in such a way that they're going to see that the only rational course of action for them is to obey or face the brutal consequences of the kind of exercise of power that certainly dominates a great deal of political history. We find many governments down through history have taken that view. The way to exercise authority is to essentially have a kind of dominant, powerful presence through a military machine or some such thing, and people are simply forced, coerced, whether they like it or not, into submission to that authority. That's one view, and certainly that's been out there. We've seen plenty of examples in our own culture of people, if they don't get their political way, all they do is scream and shout and throw things and burn things and threaten things and name call and do all sorts of things that have very little to do with rational discourse in the public square, but have everything to do with intimidation. That's a very common idea, and certainly we've seen plenty of it in history. There is another paradigm, however, that's very important and has been quite influential in history, and that simply stands for the idea that political authority originates outside of us, that we don't gin up out of simple power, a kind of might makes right philosophy, the authority by which we force other people into submission. That there is an authority that lies outside of us. It originates really in heaven. It originates with God. This is the root of the word, actually. The Greek word authority is exousia, literally ex out of, ousia, stuff or weight. that there's a kind of weight of dignity that's associated with true and legitimate authority. And we really are going to be reduced to one of those two choices. The only game in town is one of those two. Either we are going to use raw power to basically force other people into submission, or we are going to submit to a higher authority and try to institute governments that reflect the fact that there is a reality outside ourselves, and that we should be thinking about that authority when we get around to the business of constructing a political philosophy. Well, as to the first of these, there have been many attempts, some of them not bad, really, to try to figure out how can we have authority in our human existence without really resting or relying too much on authority that may come from God or the gods or any kind of supernatural power. I think probably the most famous of these, maybe one of the most brilliantly constructed, is from Aristotle, the great Greek philosopher who really tried to, you know, give a full coverage of the waterfront of human knowledge. And one of the subjects he covered in some detail was his classic On Politics. And in that work, of course, he does a fair amount of reporting as to the ways in which political life can be carried on. And in his work On Politics, he recognizes that as human beings get together and try to arrange their lives based on some kind of political apparatus, it really reduces to three possible options. The first of these he calls monarchy. It's rule by one. And of course, history is filled with examples of those civilizations that have attempted to organize themselves based on rule by one person. Thomas Hobbes made famous the idea of Leviathan, one great central authority, and that everybody else should be subjected to that authority. And Aristotle was aware of that and gave certain discussion of it. He also argued that another way in which government can be approached is aristocracy. Aristocracy depends on the idea that we simply assume that some people come into this world better suited to rule than others. There are some people who have, simply by their birth, some kind of superior status. You've heard the expression noblesse oblige, the obligations of the nobles. This is the notion that people come into this world and they simply have a fundamental intrinsic responsibility to try to exercise authority, and the rest of the people, the commoners, you know, should be smart enough to obey them and live by their guidance and their rule and that sort of thing. We hope it'll be benign. Aristotle does too, but nevertheless, that's one model in which you have kind of a small group of essentially aristocrats who exercise authority over the rest. Another form that he recognizes was called democracy. Democracy essentially meaning demo is people and kratos, the Greek word for power, power in the people, literally. What does that mean? It means that there's going to be a kind of majoritarian rule. Whatever the majority wants is what the majority should get, and that principle should be carried out and reflected in the way that we do our political life. Aristotle was wise enough to know that each one of these can be seriously distorted, and that was one of the major topics he discussed. So he said, even though we know that monarchy is a possible way of doing government, we also know that tyranny is often a form of monarchy. There's that famous phrase from Lord Acton, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. If we give absolute power to one person, it becomes an almost irresistible temptation to use that power, not for benign purposes, not for purposes that really suit the best interests of those who are being ruled, but begin to increasingly suit the interest of the one who has the power. And that is so obvious from history, it doesn't take any big argument or a lot of illustrations to make the point. I think you know that we've seen plenty of people who were given absolute power and used it in a way that was hardly consistent with what you'd call the best interests of the people. Aristocracy, by the same token, can devolve into oligarchy. Oligarchy really doesn't have much to do with a class of people who are viewed as superior. It just has to do with a minority of people who, for one reason or another, have been able to gather to themselves the political power that they can exercise against the rest. And so you have a minority that is essentially exercising control over the majority. imposing their rule, and not necessarily once again for the best interests of the people. They're doing this essentially based on their own interests, and the people, because of lack of power, are forced to basically submit to it. Aristotle also was aware that democracy itself could devolve into what I'll call mob rule. He doesn't use that term exactly, but it's certainly what he's describing. Majorities can become tyrants. There is the tyranny of the majority. You know that if you have a majority standing for a certain idea, that they can be brutally harsh with minorities. And so once again, even though it may be a majoritarian principle, the amount of damage, the amount of destruction and horrific behavior that can flow out of a democracy is really one of the most sobering aspects of the lessons of history. It's really a kind of a lesson to us that we are corrupted. We are corrupt people. And if you start giving power to people, then the chances are that sooner or later that power may be abused, and may be very much abused at the expense of those who don't have the power necessarily to fight back. Aristotle scratched his head about this. He was aware, you know, that he had a bit of a problem here. He wasn't trying to base his political philosophy on the notion of God or the gods or those things that are supernatural. Aristotle believed in God, but the God he believed in was very different from the biblical God. It was his unmoved mover, a kind of distant, detached, uninterested, maybe even unaware, a deity mostly thinking about himself, you know, that sort of thing. You don't really rely on such a deity to become a robust presence in your political philosophy, and Aristotle didn't. He was trying to figure out, how do we do government? If we're getting power from the people, how do you exactly prevent any particular faction, even a majority, from becoming a tyranny? And that was what he was wrestling with. And the answer he came up with was what he called a kind of constitutional government. A constitutional government in which the people would buy off on a certain arrangement of power, essentially combining the two features I've mentioned here, aristocracy and democracy. He felt that if we could balance the power between these two, we had the best chance of preventing some kind of power out of control to take over, and so that's what he argued for. Actually, it's interesting, in the American political divisions of labor, we have something like that, kind of tipping our hat to the insight there of Aristotle. You know that in the original arrangement of the Constitution, the branches of government are important, but they're not equal. We've sort of mistaken the thought that we have equal branches of government. That was never the design. It was Madison's view, and the framers generally accepted the idea that the principal power of government would be in the legislative branch. It's the first article of the Constitution. And you'll notice the legislative branch is divided into two houses. The second article has to do with the presidency. I would say, now this is my idea, so you can take it or leave it, but I think in the construction of the Constitution, you'd say about 50% of political power rests in the legislative branch. Probably about 40% rests in the executive branch. The executive has great power, but the executive can be overruled. A veto can be overruled by the legislative branch. By the same token, you have the judicial branch. It has about 10% of the power in the original conception. It's like the umpire in a baseball game, you know, or a basketball game. You got people running around in striped shirts. They don't score points. They don't exercise kind of athletic prowess out there. Their job is simply to make sure everybody plays by the rules. And that was really the idea in our system of government. So we have the legislative branch, but because the legislative branch had the most power, the framers decided it would be wise to split the authority of the legislative branch right down the middle and create two houses. And one of those houses is more or less an aristocratic house. We call it the Senate. You know the characteristics of the Senate. People have to be older to be members of the Senate. They hold terms for a longer period of time. Originally, senators weren't even chosen by the people. They were chosen by the state legislatures. That did change eventually, but it still stands for the idea that the senators represented in some way, you might say a kind of aristocratic flavor in our legislative branch, whereas the House of Representatives was very different. People could be younger and be in the House of Representatives. The election cycle was much more rapid, every 2 years. You know, virtually from the day a person wins an election, they're having to run for re-election. 2 years is like a heartbeat, you know, in political life. And these people who were in the House of Representatives, there's more of them. It's more democratic in that sense. They're closer to the people they represent. It's possible you may be acquainted with your representative in your state, wherever it might be, if you're living here in the United States. There is a kind of more democratic flavor to the House of Representatives, and those two taken together rather balance the power. So even in the House, or I should say even in the legislative branch, we were aware of the risks of too much authority and split that down the middle so that it would tend to dilute the ability of these to exercise too much power. One way or another, though, Aristotle was aware that he was running some problems. He had some risks. The great Christian intellectual of the nation of India, in his writings and in his speaking, has often said these words, that people who refuse to be ruled by a holy God will inevitably be ruled by sinful men, and women, I might add, as well. And that is irrefutably true. If we disclaim the rule of God among us, then we're going to be stuck with the rule of people, and people are demonstrably depraved. They are given to self-interest in the extreme. And really, the proper role of government is try to figure out how to keep any one branch of government or any one person and so on from getting too much power. That was what Aristotle wrestled with. And of course, his entire political philosophy was really a rather elaborate attempt at trying to avoid having any one branch of government or any one person get too much power. Well, the other approach, which has been very important down through history, is to simply frankly acknowledge right at the front door of our political philosophy that we need to recognize there is an authority that comes from outside of our humanity, that we human beings are ultimately subject to a greater authority, a heavenly authority, and that, of course, ultimately is to be traced back to God, the God who created us. This was the view almost universally of the great ancient lawgivers. You know, in the ancient world, there were certain people who were famous for being lawgivers. They weren't necessarily law rulers. In fact, usually they were not. But they were the ones who took it upon themselves to try to develop for us a way of doing government, of doing law, and so on, that would essentially do the greatest good, you might say, for people. And virtually all of them made quite express and important reference to some sort of authority outside themselves. Menes, the great founder of the Egyptian civilization back in the primordial days of Egyptian history, certainly did that. Hammurabi, the great king of Babylon, has a preamble in which he makes quite express and detailed reference to having received his law from God. He wants to, or from the gods in his case, he wants to make sure that people don't simply think this was his own creative genius, that he was able to get this from on high. Lycurgus in Sparta, along with Solon in Athens of Greece, both of them appealed to the gods as the great sponsors of the legislative work that they did and so on. Numa in Rome, during the period of the monarchs there in Rome, starting in 753 BC, also made express reference to the gods standing behind his law. Moses, of course, is the great lawgiver that we think of in biblical terms. Moses was also one who, of course, in chapter 19 of Exodus, makes quite a robust reference to God and to the role that God plays. And so all of these share that in common. E.C. Wines, the great kind of philosopher of biblical thought back in the 19th century, in his book on the branches of political power in ancient Israel, says, quote, "Others employed religion in establishing their political institutions, while Moses made use of civil constitution as a means of perpetuating religion." That's the big difference, you might say, between Moses on the one hand and these others, was that the others tried to use the gods to buttress their own legislative proposals. Moses, on the other hand, wanted to use the legislative proposals, the political power, the branches of government to advance the proper worship of God. His really purposes went in a different direction. But aside from that, you see the similarity there as well. Throughout history, we've certainly seen that the greatest jurists, political philosophers, have virtually invariably wanted to trace authority outside of themselves. Out of the Reformation, especially the Scottish Reformation, the architect of whom was John Knox, of course, you have Samuel Rutherford, who came about a generation later. And his wonderful work, Lex Rex, stands principally for this proposition. Law is king. Not the king is the law, not untrammeled power, being traced back into a kind of monarch, you know, or a ruling authority of some sort. That ultimately, law is king. And of course, the law is not something ultimately we invented. We have to be involved in lawmaking and so on. But ultimately, the fundamental presence of law and expression of law traces back to God. John Locke grew up in a Puritan home. His father fought in the Puritan Revolution there in England. He was deeply influenced by Puritan ideas, though we don't consider Locke himself a Puritan, but he was certainly a theist, probably a Christian, and he was one who once again made very overt reference to the importance of a notion of God lying behind our laws, and he was one of the most important and influential political philosophers of the day at the time of the founding of the American Constitution. And many of the founders, of course, made frequent reference to Locke and admired his work very deeply. Charles Montesquieu, living in the 1600s, was one of my date there, I think, is incorrect. I say 1689, it should be to 1755, apologize for that. But nevertheless, Montesquieu also had an important role to play, and he also took the view that law has to be traced back to a divine kind of foundation. The most important and famous commentator on law in England at the time of the American Revolution was William Blackstone. William Blackstone, whose name you know. Blackstone was, during, you'd say, the first century of American history, the most famous jurist in the world from the point of view of American thought. His influence was really exceeded by nobody. He wrote a famous work, Commentaries on the Laws of England. There was a time when if a person was going to be a lawyer in the United States, it was essential. In fact, it was just presupposed that a person would have mastered the works of William Blackstone, that was considered foundational to any legal education. I went to law school myself, you probably know, and I think probably I heard the name Blackstone maybe twice in my entire career. That's how much things have changed. The change came courtesy of Oliver Wendell Holmes around the turn of the 20th century. I'll save that discussion for another time. But before that, before Holmes, of course, William Blackstone was most important. Well, he made no bones about his commitment to the idea that our laws must be traced back to the power of God. That was simply taken for granted, and he believed that any legal system that ignored that did so very much at its peril. He believed that God had created us and written his law into nature, and hence we have the notion of natural law. Blackstone didn't invent that. Thomas Aquinas, of course, had argued the same thing. Many others down through history. Paul himself in Romans chapter 2 makes reference to what I think we could construe to be natural law. The idea that written in the human conscience, written in nature generally, is a fundamental principle of ethics that we all know intuitively. And the task of the lawmakers in a given society is to create laws that are compatible with natural law, which indeed traces its content back to God. So in the very beginning of his great work on Commentaries on the Laws of England, Blackstone says, quote, "This law of nature, being coeval with mankind, dictated by God himself, is of course superior in obligation to any other. It's binding over all the globe, in all countries, and at all times. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this, and such of them as are valid derive all their force and all their authority, mediately or immediately, from this original. God is the original author of law. He writes it into nature. Our job is to reflect that law in our laws." So you have three levels of law from Blackstone, from Thomas Aquinas, from other jurists down through history. You have eternal law coming from God, found in the Bible. You have natural law written into the structure of things in creation. And then you have what's called positive law. This is legislative law, which must reflect, of course, that greater law that we find in nature. This was the view that was taken for granted by the American founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson obviously was no robust Christian, you know. I don't think he had Christian faith at all, but nevertheless, he reflects what is a thoroughly Christian outlook in the great philosophical declaration, kind of a philosophical affirmation of how we are going to run this new nation. This is something like the Articles of Incorporation. I've heard some people say that the Declaration of Independence is not law. Well, that's true. It certainly is not law. It wasn't intended to be law. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, but the Declaration of Independence announces, here is the foundation upon which we are going to do law. This is how we're going to do our Constitution. This is how we're going to proceed. And even Jefferson makes no apologies for his affirmations. We hold these truths to be self-evident, he says. And of course, then he names some of the things that he says are self-evident. All men are created equal or endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. You might ask Thomas, by the way, where did you exactly get the idea that all men are created equal? Because I'm going to tell you, though we take that statement somewhat for granted, at the time Thomas Jefferson wrote it, it was an almost unbelievable novelty to say all men are created equal. Where did that come from? Certainly didn't come from England. England still had a robust idea of a nobility and a common class. Some people were superior to others, and aristocracy was the order of the day in merry old England. Certainly didn't come from France. France had a stratified society that eventually led to the French Revolution. It didn't even come after the French Revolution, when people were being executed by the thousands at the guillotine, not because of anything they did, but because of status. Simply status said some people deserve to live and others didn't. Even if you go back to someone as enlightened as Aristotle, Aristotle said unabashedly that some people were born to be slaves, some people were born to be free. You will look in vain, I tell you, you will look in vain down through history for anyone that really makes a reliable case for the notion that all men are created equal, such as you find it in Thomas Jefferson, except for one example, and that is in the Protestant Reformation, especially the Reformed branch of it, the Calvinistic branch of it, where Calvin maintained with a straight face, all men are created equal. You don't find it so much in Luther, even. Luther I love. He's one of my Christian heroes, but he also is willing to allow that there are princes, you know, and there's common, and he assumes that and operates on that assumption. But it's John Calvin who says, we come into this world broken, wretched people, sinful to our core, and that applies whether you're the king or whether you're a pauper or anything in between. At this point, we all share an equal heritage of brokenness and helplessness and desperate need for mercy. At the most fundamental level that we could even think about in our human existence, we are equal. And that came straight out of the Protestant Reformation. It trickled down into English Puritanism, into Scottish Presbyterianism. It was brought wholesale into the colonies, and it was the working assumption at the time, and that's where Jefferson got it. He never acknowledged it, of course. He probably wouldn't want to. But in terms of practical, historical source criticism, you'd have to say that's the only place it could come from. It's the only source at the time that would have been anything remotely leading to the proposition that all men are created equal and that that is in fact self-evident. How could it be self-evident? If there's anything that's obvious, it's that nobody seems to be equal with anybody. We differ in intellectual power, we differ in socioeconomic status, we differ in skin color, we differ in racial and ethnicity, etc. All of these things seem to differentiate us, and yet, at the one point that matters the most, we are all absolutely equal. And we in our American experiment in governance were willing to take that so seriously that we made it part of our original philosophical foundational affirmation. What is self-evident? That all men are created. We didn't just come into being in some kind of accidental process, but we were created, and we were created equal. God is the one who created us originally in equal dignity. And by virtue of the fall, we come into this world not only with equal dignity, but with equal brokenness. And that that applies to everybody, regardless of their social station otherwise. But this God who created us has endowed us with certain unalienable rights. We are created, we have a creator, and that creator is the source of rights that cannot be taken away legitimately. Unalienable rights. Among these, this is not an exclusive list, an exhaustive list, it's simply a representative sample or a right to a life, to liberty, to pursue true satisfaction in life, the sense of the word happiness, and that governments are not here to create rights, but to secure rights. There's a big difference, isn't there? If government creates rights, then government can take them away. Government that creates rights becomes something like a god in our lives. But if government is there to secure rights, the presupposition is that the rights came from somewhere else, and the proper role of government then is to make sure that you can enjoy the rights that you got from God, that nobody is going to gratuitously take them from you, but that you in fact have a right to enjoy them, and government is there to make sure that you are able to do that, to secure these rights. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The reason it's the consent of the governed is because the idea is that God has created us equal, and that therefore, fundamentally, God is providing these rights to everybody on an equal basis. He gives the rights to the people, and the people then should consent based on the authority of God to a certain form of government, whatever may be the view that is accepted in that connection. And therefore, government has a fundamental duty to the governed based on the fact that rights were given by God. That's the basic idea. That's the first principle, you might say, of government, and it has to do with where did that authority come from. I might mention just one additional detail here as we wrap up, that the biblical view, of course, as you remember, was that it's one God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. The reason there's such an important emphasis on the oneness of God is because polytheistic cultures tend to get into some big problems. You know, you've heard the old expression that, at the dinner table, we don't talk about religion and we don't talk about politics. I don't know if that's the rule in your family. It certainly was not the rule in my family. We talked about both of them a lot. When I had young people at home, it was one of our major, topics of conversation. But be that as it may, the reason for that is because, of course, your religious views and your political views go to the very deepest level of who you are. There is no deeper, more profound level of who you are. And whether you're a Christian or an atheist or a Buddhist or a Hindu or whatever it might be, you have religious convictions. Atheists are some of the most religious people in the world, And that religious conviction is not usually there as a result of a conclusion from a deductive syllogism. Usually it's a given. It's already there, it's foundational, and we use our reason to defend it rather than to reason our way to it. That's why it's so hard, of course, to reach a person's most deep religious and political outlook. Well, if you are in a polytheistic culture, then you have multiple commitments to multiple deities that do not share the same values. So one person might have a value system that wants to elevate one item, you know, environmentalism. Somebody else wants to save the whales. Somebody else wants to fight global warming. Someone else wants to fight something else. And the point is, people can be aligned to all kinds of values that may not necessarily share the same strategies, intentions, purposes. There's no unifying principle to bring it all together, and it's really a recipe for civil war when you have polytheistic understanding. So the Ten Commandments makes it very clear there's one God. Lady Justice there pointing her sword down is standing on a book that stands for the idea, the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were inscribed in our great judicial and legislative houses back in the day, and all of those, of course, stood for the idea that there's one source of authority, not multiple authorities, not multiple gods, but one God, and that that becomes the unifying principle upon which we can do government as we attempt to do it in our particular social situation. So that's the idea. Hope that's helpful. We're just beginning here. This is kind of basic stuff, but as we go along, we're going to be looking at the various political principles and philosophical ideas that are shot through the Old Testament, especially in the writings of Moses, and especially traced through and see how those were implemented, and really many times with a complete acknowledgement of their sources by those who were involved in establishing the fundamental principles of the American Republic. So thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. I expect we'll have more of these as we go along, and appreciate your interest in this material. So until next time, may God richly bless you. Thank you.